La 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 la. Hi everyone, this week's podcast is sponsored by the Japan Prize, Qatar Foundation International and Class Central. This week is the last time we promote the good work of the Japan Prize. You may have heard previously from Japan Prize Secretary Yuki Yoshida, but just to recap, the prize was set up by Japan's state broadcaster NHK in 1965 to promote excellent educational media resources. If that sounds like you, get involved. Entries are free and open until the end of June, and if you have educational audiovisual resources in the form of a website, game, app or other, go to nhk.or.jp/jp-prize/English to enter, and you'll be pleased to know that the link for that is in the show notes. International entries are encouraged and top nominees get flown out to the awards ceremony in Tokyo in October. And with the Japanese curriculum incorporating computing and coding in 2020, that's not a bad place to be. Boom! Hello everyone! The past week has been a bit of a whirlwind with stops at Utah for ASU-JSV Summit, Norway for Catapult Future Tech, and Denmark for the LEGO Conference. A big hello to everyone I met or who was involved along the way. We're now firmly back in the UK and gearing up towards London EdTech Week, where we are collaborating with Nesta on an event titled Is EdTech a Thing? Supported by Cooley LLC. Guest speakers will include Richard Taylor, Angel EdTech Investor, Lucy Heady, Impact Director at Nesta Investments, Buki Youssef, Secondary Science Teacher, Consultant and Qualified Coach, and Matt Johnson, Senior Associate Education, Education Technology and Privacy and Data Security Practice Group at Cooley. We'll be looking at how to value EdTech. Is it purely financial, social impact, economic competitiveness or opportunity cost? And we'd love for you to join us. Registration details are in the show notes and a big shout out to Cooley LLC for supporting the event. In other news, I've got capacity back as tangential brain for freelance work among the edu and edtech community. What does that mean? Well, it could mean community engagement, events, content marketing, strategic partnerships, or international launches. I've got a ton of references, so if you need a bit of extra flex on your team for interesting and engaging work with a remote powerhouse, do drop me a line at theedtechpodcast@gmail.com. What's next? Let's welcome new sponsors QFI. Qatar Foundation International is a US-based member of Qatar Foundation. QFI operates as both a grant-making organisation and a convener of thought leaders on issues related to global and international education, open education and education technologies as they intersect three core QFI programmatic areas, those being Arabic language and Arab culture, STEAM and youth engagement. QFI inspires meaningful connections to the Arab world by creating a global community of diverse learners and educators and connecting them through effective and collaborative learning environments inside and outside of the classroom. Through their activities, QFI is committed to providing K-12 students in Qatar, the Americas and the United Kingdom with the intellectual, communicative and cultural competencies that will enable them to be engaged global citizens. If you're keen to get involved as a teacher, do contact me about their programmes. Right, on to this week's show. This week we're back at South by Southwest EDU 17 looking at K-12 trends with Nina Rees, President and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, Anthony A. Owen, State Coord of Computer Science at Arkansas Department of Education, Michael Cohen, the Tech Rabbi or EdTech Trainer, and Alex Rosenthal, Editorial Director of TED-Ed. We're talking about charter schools and the current discussions around education school choice, how computer science gained status in Arkansas, which I originally called Arkansas, like an absolute rookie with a Wizard of Oz fetish. Sorry, Anthony. How can design thinking interest students and educators? And what's next for TED-Ed after millions of YouTube views? Okay, I'm off to a hen do, so let's go. So I'm delighted to be here with Nina Rees, who's the President and CEO for the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. So welcome, Nina.
Thanks for having me.
So my first question really is, I think for the listeners to really go back down to basics, lots of the listeners who are hearing this won't be familiar perhaps firsthand with the educational landscape in the US. So going back to what charter schools are and how that fits in with the other versions of schooling systems that you have here as well.
Well, again, thank you for having me. Charter schools have now been around for 25 years. You know, I don't know what the equivalent of a charter school is in the UK. You have contract schools in some instances.
Yeah, so we have academies now. So lots of secondary schools are academized, which just means that the pot of money is not with a local authority, but it's with the school themselves.
Right. So, you know, at the most kind of basic level, a charter school is a school where the school leader has a degree of autonomy to do things differently from what the school district is assigning schools. In exchange for that autonomy, they're held accountable for raising student achievement. There's a contract that they sign with their authorizer. That authorizer, depending on the state that the charter is housed in, can be the school district, it can be the state education agency, it could be a university, or it could be a nonprofit. Yeah. And those entities are ultimately responsible to make sure that the school is holding their end of the bargain, whatever that may be.
And as a percentage of all the schools out there in the US, how many are charter schools at the moment?
It's fairly small. Nationally, it's only about 6%. Yeah. But in some communities, the number is much higher. So I live in Washington, D.C., and nearly 50% of the students are in charter schools now. New Orleans went to an all-charter system when Hurricane Katrina hit the city. So most all the schools in New Orleans right now are charter schools.
And I mean, so from your point of view, what are your objectives from a sort of national organization point of view? So is it to perhaps evangelize that model of education and the opportunities that it allows for? Or, you know, when you're having conversations here, what kind of people are you connecting with?
That's a great question. Our goal is pretty simple. It is to expand the number of high-quality public schools that are available to low-income students in particular. Yeah. And we're using chartering as the strategy to make those options available, because in many districts, you're assigned to your public school, and unless you have the means to send your child to a private school, you really don't have any other options short of moving to another school district.
Yes. And as I understand it, you have soon to be coming in coupon system or voucher system. Mm-hmm. Where how does that fit in with?
It doesn't. Vouchers are another reform that has been talked about quite a bit, and we only advocate for the growth of high quality public charter schools because charters are in the public domain. In fact, in many states that enacted charter school laws, the reason from a political standpoint it was easier to pass a charter school law is because of the momentum behind vouchers, primarily in low-income communities where parents wanted an option to attend a better school. So it was, in many places, a compromise between the need to offer more choices to these families and the importance of keeping the system in a public system and holding the schools accountable.
And I'm not sure if it's similar, but with the academies in the UK, usually what that means is that they will specialise in one particular area. So, for example, they might be focused on STEM or they might be focused on sports. And I don't know, is that something that's sort of replicated with what you do as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the diversity of our space is one that attracted me to South by Southwest. And so depending, again, on the way the charter law was written in each state, there are 43 states in the US and Washington, D.C. that now allow for charter schools. Every state approached this in a very different way. Some of the early adopters were really interested in this and giving teachers more freedom to run their own schools. Yep. Other places did it just to expand parental choice. In yet other places like Tennessee, it was specifically designed to make sure that kids in failing schools had access to better schools. So depending on how your model was framed, the diversity of the movement is reflected in it. Mm-hmm. So in those places like California, where you were able to innovate and come up with different ways of teaching and learning, you actually now have a broad menu of options that are available in the chartering space. Schools that are focused on STEM, schools that are focused on languages, schools that are have a more regimented, what's considered a no excuses approach. So that is definitely part of the fabric of the charter school system, especially in places like DC, where you almost have to come up with something somewhat different if you're interested in attracting students to your school.
Okay, and then I'm imagining some of those charter schools are probably branded, so if they're collaborating with universities and so on, Is there any appetite for those to export internationally, or is it very much a sort of domestic focus at the moment?
So this is a good question for the individuals who are running these charter schools. I know a few of them have explored expanding into the Middle East.
Yeah.
There was a for-profit company called Mosaic that had explored opening charter schools. I believe they opened a few in Istanbul and Turkey, right, and in the UAE. But I know New Zealand has explored opening charter schools. So it's going to have to depend on the appetite of the operators in the U.S.
Yeah.
and their need to expand. I think a lot of them are actually just looking at the U.S. because there's so much more to be done here.
Yes.
Exporting it doesn't always make sense.
Quite a large territory.
But at the same time, if you are testing a new way of teaching, there's no reason why you should limit your reach to the U.S.
Yeah,
if it's an innovative program. In fact, you would probably want to test it in sub-Saharan Africa and some other places to see if in fact it will be
if
a better model.
And, yeah.
Right. I would say a lot of the blended learning and online models are probably looking at space overseas, but what they're going to do in those places is going to be different from the chartering model or what they're doing in a brick and mortar charter school in the
yes.
U.S.
And how did you get into all of this? Like, what's your background?
Well, it's actually a very different background than most people. I was not a teacher, and I wasn't really... My education was in psychology and in international studies. I moved to Washington, D.C. When I turned 21 to work on Capitol Hill, and I later worked at a public interest law firm that litigated cases on behalf of poor parents who wanted
yes.
access to better schools. So my entry point was through listening to the stories of the families who wanted better options mm-hmm. and landing on charters as one of the best ways to make a good school available to families from a political standpoint as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm. And sort of thinking about that, how do the results or the outcomes, you know, when we think about exam results and assessment and so on, how do charter schools stack up generally against other types of schools?
That's a great question. So there are different ways of measuring outcomes. So we now have a little over 3 million students in charter schools, and that growth in and of itself tells you that there is demand. We did a poll last year that demonstrated that all things being equal, when you ask parents if they want a charter school in their community, most of them say yes. So yep. we really haven't tapped into the potential just yet. In terms of academic outcomes, which mm-hmm. is the question you're asking me, there are about 15 to 17 high quality studies that have been done on charter schools, and 13 out of the 15 actually indicate that students in charter schools do better academically. We tend to do best with low income students, mm-hmm. with English language learners, with Black students, and with Hispanic students. Having said that, to do a really strong study, you actually do need to have a wait list. So those states like New York and Boston or Massachusetts that have done what's called a randomized field trial have found that when you control for parental engagement, charter
yeah.
schools are, in fact, increasing student achievement. So to get at the bottom of whether there is something in the charter sauce that's mm-hmm. making a difference, you do need to be able to control for parental engagement when you do a study.
Got you, because that's such a support, you know, that support is so integral to how well
right.
the student does.
Right. And you don't want to just cream the best of the best, because that also, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, that did get me thinking, because our Conservative government in the UK is looking to reintroduce grammar schools, which is very mm-hmm. contentious, because I don't think the evidence isn't really behind those being successful for the many.
Mm-hmm.
But I wondered, that got me thinking, is there like an entry exam into a charter school? Is it
no? It's an open enrollment.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of charters, they need to attract a lot of families to in order to stay open, because they get their money once the child enrolls and they start to draw down the per pupil allocation at that point.
Yeah.
In fact, if they have more students than they have slots, they have to conduct a lottery, so they can't self-select.
Yes, and. So one question I ask all my interviewees is there a book, resource, or a person that has sort of shaped how you think and how you conduct yourself in the world? So something that perhaps you go back to again and again, and that you would recommend people listening in go and check out. So it doesn't have to be something in education or in law or anything like that. It could just be a fictional book or one that's kind of struck you.
That's a great question. I mean, in the education space, there's so many great books. I would say the book by Abigail Thernstrom, No Excuses, that came out a while back, does a really nice job of offering a historical context and then sketching the path to the importance of education reform. And I think we don't talk about that book as much, but for me, it was one of the framing pieces and one of the books.
I love this because I've got like such a big list of amazing books to go and read.
Yeah.
From all the suggestions.
But in recent years, Richard Whitmire, who's actually moderating my panel this afternoon, recently wrote a book called The Founders, which looks at the history of charter schooling through the lens of those who started charter schools. Certainly some of the, one of the chapters is focused on the very first charter management organization, Aspire Charter Schools in California. So right now, if you ask me what book would I recommend to a new employee at our organization to read, I would definitely point to that. But I mean, I pause for a second because my favorite book of all time was The Fountainhead in college, and I don't think that that's as relevant to this.
Is that a fictional novel?
This is Ayn Rand. Okay. So if you're an objectivist or, you know, to me that the importance of personal freedom and liberties is paramount to success, and in some respects, choice is about expressing your freedom and options.
Well, going back to that then, so what keeps you up at night at the moment? So there's a very interesting landscape going on and lots of changes. So I think, you know, people listening would be interested to know what challenges you face and, you know, what your kind of goals are for 2017. So
that's a great question. As you know, we're in Washington, D.C. One of the key things we do is track the role of the federal government in influencing charter schools. And fortunately, the federal government, since Bill Clinton became president, when charter schools were first enacted, has been one of charter schools' best friends. So from President Bill Clinton to President George Bush to President Barack Obama, all three of them have put a lot of money in federal programs to support the growth of charter schools. And it looks like Mr. Trump is also about to put money into the program. So we are excited that that there is receptivity to charter schools as a concept and that hopefully there's going to be some resources available. In terms of what keeps me up at night, when you look at the trajectory of growth for charter schools, we are noticing an increase in the number of students who are attending charter schools, but the number of new schools that are opening is not as steady or as high as it once was. And there are a lot of reasons for that. In some states, you know, there's no talent pipeline. Access to facilities remains one of the key reasons why a lot of charter schools can't open very rapidly, and it's one of the last.
So the actual real estate that you need.
Real estate is huge. And if you don't have, from a philanthropic standpoint, a steady stream of funding to support acquisition of a facility, you're often tapping into just your general operating funds to rent or lease a building, which is expensive in some places like New York City, as you know.
Oh, absolutely,
those things can skyrocket.
I don't know if it's the same here as well, but in the UK there is a great focus and stress for leaders is on the recruitment crisis, but it's actually a retention crisis mostly of retaining staff who are exiting sort of public education because of the stresses. I don't know if it's similar here.
It is, in fact. So recruiting teachers, keeping them, about 50% of teachers actually leave the workforce within about 5 years. I was just looking at a statistic recently. So this is regardless of whether you're in a charter or in a public school. I would say also in the millennial generation, the tendency to stay with one job for a very long period of time doesn't exist anymore.
No.
So I don't necessarily think retention is a problem so long as you're keeping that staff person engaged in other aspects of your schooling, if they're moving up to other roles. But with education, as you know, you become better over time. In fact, most first-year teachers will tell you that was probably their worst year. So because that seasoning helps you become better and better, you do actually need to attract the types of people who are likely to succeed and stay in a classroom over a long period of time. And without it, in a lot of these communities, hitting the reset button is pretty detrimental to the success of the students in the system.
So, and then finally, so EdTech podcast, we look at sort of educational innovation and so the role of technology or the role of certainly looking at new ideas. Is that sort of a significant part of what your sort of members are looking at with some of their schools?
Certainly a good number of them are looking at technology, both in terms of cutting costs and making it easier to access courses that you may not be able to offer through a master teacher in your school. Technology is such a big part of all of our lives. I would say one thing, though, in our space, we're very careful in making sure people understand it's a tool towards a goal. It's not the goal in and of itself. And so we discourage people from spending too much time on these tools. And of course, there's a lot of research on this because the tool can take a long time to get used to, embed, and then you're on to something else. So unless you're not careful in what it is that you're using it for, you can spend a lot of time, energy, and money on tools that you end up not using. But all things being equal, I think it is the wave of the future, and the faster our teachers can master using it, and the students certainly have learned how to use it and are connected to it now more than ever before.
So our government just released its digital strategy. The EdTech part of that was looking at, there's an organisation called the Education Endowment Fund. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but they've sort of provided, I suppose, the framework for exactly that. So looking at how to measure which educational tools have impact. I don't know if there's an equivalent to that kind of organisation here where, you know, teachers or principals can go and say, okay, well, Is this a useful investment? So does it meet key criteria? Does it have impact?
Well, I mean, the closest thing I can think of is a program that was enacted during the Obama administration called I3, which was an attempt at helping scale those innovations that had the potential to scale. And so there were three buckets of funding that was available. The first was to a new startup that had a promising idea, and those entities got small amounts of money to expand their products. The mid-level grants went to those that had something that was ready to scale but wasn't researched yet to see if it could scale well. And the last bucket went to groups like Teach for America, which had been doing this work for a while and had entities like Mathematica that had tested their program to see if it's in fact effective at raising student achievement. So from a funding standpoint, that incentive structure offered entrepreneurs an opportunity to tap into funding to research and then scale their program. I don't know if this is what you were asking me about.
But it's certainly of interest anyway, because I think people listening in are always like trying to navigate these things. There's so many initiatives and things out there. Do you know if it's still going, that one?
Well, hopefully if Congress continues funding it, the answer is yes. But my experience in Washington that tells me one quick thing. Usually new initiatives that an administration starts which don't have a steady base of constituents tend to be marginalized when funding is at issue. So I don't know if it's going to continue, but that model is no different than how some venture philanthropists and foundations have approached giving. So I would hope that some foundations will continue using that as a model, because a lot of work went into creating the framework for how to disseminate the money, how to consider grant applications. And I think what they ended up producing was pretty rigorous at the end.
And if people want to get in contact with you, Nina, how do they go about doing that?
Well, they can come to our website, which is publiccharters.org. They can follow me on Twitter at Nina Charters. And again, our website also has links to reach me personally if they want to reach out to me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So I'm here with Anthony Owen, who is the State Coordinator for Computer Science for the Arkansas Department of Education. And Anthony, we finally met one another after communicating from different hotels, the JW Marriott and the Hilton. So now we've finally met in the middle, which is awesome. So could you, just to kick off, perhaps explain about what your role encompasses and introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners?
Sure. Well, I am the Arkansas State Director of Computer Science Education, and yeah, it is Arkansas. I know everybody. No, that's okay. Everybody
Someone
tries
even
to say
told
Arkansas,
me that, you know.
But we like to do our own thing, Arkansas. In fact, we have legislation that surrounds the correct pronunciation.
Oh, dear.
But that's okay. You're in Texas, so we won't do anything about it here. But yes, I'm State Director of Computer Science Education under Governor Asa Hutchinson, who made computer science for all Arkansas students a campaign promise, and since he was elected in 2014, started serving in 2015, has really doubled down and made it a very specific focus of his administration, and ensuring that we as a state are preparing our students to meet the technology needs of our future workforce, the security needs of our nation, and just the computational and analytical thinking needs that all students need through computer science.
So how's that kind of bedded in terms of the curriculum in Arkansas? Because, say, for example, in the UK, we had a change of curriculum in 2014, and that really focused everyone around, you know, compulsory computing and coding in the curriculum from primary school upwards. And that was quite a big change for us. I didn't know if there's something equivalent here as well.
Well, yes. Actually, after Governor Hutchinson took office in January 2015, he worked with our state legislature to pass what we refer to as Act 187, which made every high school, or it compelled every high school in the state of Arkansas to offer at least one computer science course to all students. You know, the year before that initiative was in place, what we recognized as computer science classes, we had about 1,100 students taking one of those courses statewide at the high school level. The year that that was implemented, we jumped to almost 4,000. It was like 3,986, I believe. And then this year, we're actually up to 5,500. So just by making computer science available to every student in Arkansas, we're seeing an increased enrollment. We are not making students to take it, but we are making schools or we are having schools make it available for students. Early on in the process, the governor asked me, you know, could we meet a goal of having 20% of Arkansas students graduating with one computer science credit on their transcript? And I very quickly said, yes, Governor, we can meet that goal. But if we don't look at earlier grade levels, if we don't make computer science part of the K-8 educational system, the vast majority are going to look like me, which is geeky, white, and male. And so we have to make computer science really a normal part of the educational process for our earlier students or for our younger students. So when they get to high school, these preconceived notions that computer science are only for certain demographics or certain people has disappeared. So not only have we developed a whole new grid of high school computer science courses, high quality, but we are implementing, beginning next year, K-8 embedded standards for every Arkansas student.
So your specialism is around computer science and mathematics. So how has that kind of shaped your career path, I suppose?
Well, I was very fortunate, having come from the mathematics background and served in the capacity of the mathematics specialist for the Department of Ed prior to stepping in this role as State Director for Computer Science Education, because through those 4 years of work under the Department of Ed and working within the government system and working to see what is actually involved with standards development and implementation of different initiatives, I learned a lot of lessons and a lot of things that that I have been able to do under the Computer Science Initiative, because it is a brand new initiative in Arkansas. So, you know, we're basically being able to write the book on a large-scale initiative of this sort. And right now, Arkansas is being recognized as leading the United States in this particular effort out of all 50 states.
And are there sort of national initiatives that you recognize as well? So at home, we have Computers at School, which is trying to support teachers who are, you know, new to embedding these content aspects of the curriculum. So I don't know if there's so many initiatives out there. I don't know if there's ones that you recommend that listeners go and look up as well.
Well, yes, I'm on the national board for the Computer Science Teachers Association.
Okay, yeah.
of the U.S. And actually, it's not of the U.S. It's actually international community.
Oh, yeah.
So I would encourage any listeners from across the world to join CSTA. It is open. It's open for enrollment to anyone in the world that has an interest in computer science. Beyond Computer Science Teachers Association, the K-12 community framework, which was developed in partnership with Code.org, ACM, CIC, and I'm going to leave somebody out, but there were multiple partners that came together to develop that framework. I was actually one of the lead writers on that, and that was a very valuable experience. And what that framework does is it does not define standards, but it gives schools and state entities a roadmap for which that they can use to develop standards or to implement computer science statewide. Mm-hmm. And Code.org has been a great partner to Arkansas recently. In fact, we're finalizing a blog this week that we were the first state to meet all nine of their policy suggestions, first and only state still. So I would recommend other states looking to those policy suggestions and try to join us.
As I've had conversations with everyone this week, you know, there's a huge amount of change going on at the moment. What keeps you up at night? And you know, are you worried about any of the changes that may come, or is it opportunity in there as well?
Well, I think that, you know, the beautiful thing about Computer Science for All, and that's another national initiative, and I don't want to leave them out. CS for All has been a great leader in this initiative. Yep. But the beautiful thing about Computer Science for All is that it is a nonpartisan issue. Mm-hmm. So really, the political climate changes don't keep me up at night. They don't worry me a whole lot. I think that everybody sees the need for having a populace that understands the precepts of computer science and cybersecurity. I mean, even with the announcement today of the WikiLeaks of the CIA leaks and the new Vault 7 being released, you know, publicly, that just demonstrates our need as a nation to ensure that we have a populace that understands computer science concepts, and that spans all political arenas. You know, I'm privileged to come from a state that has a governor who has led this initiative, and he's Republican, but yet we have Washington on the other side who's also leading this initiative, and they're governed by a Democratic governor. So it is really a nonpartisan issue, and so I don't see the changes being causing too many problems for our states.
I mean, obviously in the playground that we've got here, there's lots of exhibitors, and at home we've got lots of edtech startups. So, you know, anything from Primo Toys or PyTop, or I mentioned before the BBC Microbit. Are there any particular resources or anything that you think are fantastic for when you mentioned going back to K-8 and then K-12 that assist teachers that you think, yeah, actually they've got a good philosophy and pedagogy behind what they're doing?
Well, you're kind of putting me on the spot there, but you know, Code.org has had a long-standing place within the computer science community of getting students with that initial engagement through their hour of code. But beyond that, you know, you have companies, Apple, that is coming to the table now with their Swift Playgrounds app, which is just phenomenal. You have Scratch and Scratch Junior that is out there. There are so many different curriculums and so many different free curriculums, but then there are also so many different paid curriculums that give maybe a next level teacher support. You know, Project Lead the Way. We have a lot of schools within the state of Arkansas that are Project Lead the Way schools, and we see phenomenal access through that particular curriculum for students.
And I don't know if there are any particular sort of challenges or, you know, something particular to the region.
The neat thing about Arkansas when you live there is that we have five geographic regions in Arkansas. You know, it spans from the Delta Alluvial Plain, where we share grow crops, row crops, up to the beautiful mountains of the Ozark Mountain Range in northwest Arkansas. And, you know, the thing about that is that provides challenges sometimes for students with access to technology and connectivity. Mm-hmm. We also have you know, some very poor areas of our state and some very economically challenged areas of our state, let me say it that way. But, you know, the entirety of my computer science initiative in my office, you know, our saying is that there are no excuses, and we're not going to accept excuses in Arkansas. My office doesn't accept excuses. Governor Hutchinson doesn't accept excuses from my office. We're going to find a way to make computer science education work in Arkansas.
Amazing. And what was your own education like as well? So I was interested in, you know, how someone's come to be in the position they are and how that reflected your own philosophy of education, I suppose.
Well, I like to remind people I'm not too far removed from the classroom, but prior to the classroom, I was actually in corporate world, worked in corporate world for five years, which I think gives me a lot of the no excuses mentality because in corporate it's not about, you know, if you don't produce, you're going to the house and they'll find somebody who can. And I think that that is something that definitely our educational system across the nation can be infused with, is that we have to start having high expectations for our students, having high expectations for our teachers. And guess what? If we communicate those high expectations and we establish those high expectations, they will rise to that challenge. Mm-hmm. But as long as we continue to make excuses for why things can't be done, the bar will be lowered to those excuses also.
So what would you like to see more of?
I would like to see more of more innovation. You know, I get asked quite often from other states how we were able to move the computer science initiative so quickly in Arkansas. And one reason is because I do have the governor supporting the initiative, which makes things run a little bit more smoothly, and a legislature that has been very generous with funding. But also the best thing is that my office has been given the authority to go out and make changes in the educational system that are needed to be made. And, you know, our Commissioner of Education, Johnny Key, has just been a wonderful individual in this initiative, and he's bringing a new air to the State Department and other subject areas also. And I think nationwide, though, we have to stop assuming that everything in education has to take a long time. Mm-hmm. And that is the assumption that everything in state government, everything in federal government, everything has to take a long time. But quite often, it's not because of regulations or policies or legislation. It's because of practice. So people around the agency that know me, around the state agency that I work in that know me, they know that one of the first things that I'll ask whenever they say we can't do that, I'll ask, is it legislation, is it regulation, or is it practice? Because if it's practice, it's something that we may need to look at and change fairly quickly. If it's legislation, we can work on that through members of Congress.
You have that look as well. So I'm like, oh,
well, that's
God.
That's the lawyer in me. So I am a lawyer also.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, I'm not messing with that look. That's quite funny. Next question was about whether there have been books, people, or resources so that impact you in the way that you think about the world or that you continue to go back to. So books have had an influence on you. And it doesn't have to be, you know, it could be fiction, nonfiction, doesn't have to be in education either.
Well, there are many books that and resources that have kind of, that I have developed a mindset under, but really my focus under education and my statement of no excuses, which I had whenever I was a math teacher also, I had for my students, goes back to one man, and that gentleman's name is Dr. William Durand, who was a professor at Henderson State University, and he's still a professor emeritus there, but he was the chair of the mathematics department there at Henderson State, where I did my undergraduate and my master's work. And Dr. Durand never accepted excuses for his math students, and he always said, especially those that were going out as educators, he said, I'm not going to accept excuses. I'm not going to accept subpar work from you, because you're going to go out and you are teaching the next generation of mathematicians that are going to be building the bridges that I'll be driving over, that my grandchildren will be driving over. They're going to be the ones computing the tax rates when I pay my taxes, so on and so forth. So I want you to go out. I want to ensure that you have the knowledge that you need to go out and teach them correctly. And he was very instrumental in a part of my life that was that I'm not most proud of. I'll say it that way. We all have those instances in our life where we have to grow up sometimes. Mm-hmm. And he forced me to grow up, and he forced me to see the world for what it really was. Mm-hmm. And I keep that mentality that he imparted to all of his students on a daily basis in my office, is just no excuses.
And do you stay in contact with him?
I do.
That's nice. Yeah. So we'll give him a shout out on the podcast. So finally, how can people get in contact with you? Are you on Twitter? And
I am on Twitter. Of course, you can email me, anthony.owen@arkansas.gov, and there's no S on my last name. My Twitter feed is just Anthony Owen ADE, and the ADE is not aid as in we're giving you aid. It's aid and as in yeah. Arkansas Department of Education. But on Twitter, email, my cell phone number is public out there. My office number is public, but I hardly ever answer them. So the best way to get a hold of me is via email or Twitter.
I think I'm the same. And do you have international visitors ever?
We have had a few. So Arkansas has developed some great relationships with international entities. We would always welcome more. You know, I think that we as a state are starting to get a lot of focus. We've been able to attract industry, both national and international, to Arkansas based on this initiative. And I think you will see that continue to grow.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Anthony.
Thank you.
Next up, a word from Class Central, which, if you're into geeking out over online learning and MOOC reports like I am, you'll probably already know about. Unless you've been asleep, MOOCs or massive online open courses are changing the way we experience higher and further education and workplace learning. With significant online courses available, gaining insight into this fast-paced world is worth spending time on, especially for those implicated by such changes. That's where Class Central comes in. Not only does it list hundreds of courses, and importantly, including non-profit courses as well as the big Ivy League unis, but the MOOC Report blog has some excellent analysis on what's up, down, new, or just slightly left-field. So definitely go and check it out at www.class-central.com/report and let me know what you think. Wonderful. So I'm delighted to be here with Alex
Rosenthal.
Hello.
From TED Ed, who's the editorial producer, and you're based in Brooklyn, New York?
That's right. TED is based in Manhattan. I live in Brooklyn.
Well, Alex, we were having a conversation, and then we thought, right, let's get recording about what it is that you do. And you've been there for 2 years. So can you tell us a little bit about what it means to be the editorial producer and what it is that you do when you collaborate with educators out there?
Sure. So we at TED Ed produce about 150 short animated videos a year on every educational topic under the sun and then some. And what's unusual about us is, like with TED Talks, the TED Ed lessons are generated by educators and experts. It's not us, you know, being journalistic and seeking out the stories. We want to share the best ideas from educators to the world. And so people will pitch us, and then through our open nomination platform, which you can find on ed.ted.com, and we'll go through the proposals and we'll find the ones that seem really promising for animation and for our audience, and we'll get in touch with that person and we'll together craft a narrative for animation. And it's a really fun collaboration because our team brings the narrative chops. We know how to work with animation, but we're working with brilliant people, you know, people who are researching and people who are teaching in schools and really have the best impulses for what reaches students and how to communicate an idea. So, and then we bring in the animators, who's a third prong of that partnership.
And so do all those parties, do they all meet physically or can they do that remotely? Or
very, very virtual. So I usually start with a phone call, and after that it's mostly over email and online.
Just because I can sort of imagine the excitement once you get all those people in a room together even virtually.
It's so nice to be able to do that. But part of the advantage of our platform is we work with people around the world.
Yeah.
I think we probably have more international animators than domestic to the U.S. And our educators are absolutely around the world. I'm working with people right now in Spain and Tokyo and South America, really everywhere. And that's delightful. And so when we do get somebody who can come to the office, that's even better. But I would never sacrifice.
Well, I imagine when you go to some of these events that you potentially meet up with people that have contributed. And
absolutely, yeah. Just last night I was talking to somebody, another YouTuber named Patrick JMT, who did a video with us last year.
So cool. And so how stringent are the rules? Do you have to be an educator to contribute? Or
educator is very much a catch-all that I used. I mean, so I think I work with, it's probably a lot of professors, a lot of researchers, journalists, artists, high school teachers, middle school teachers, and then sort of outliers. Like if somebody has a really strong expertise and it somehow taps into an educational topic, we'll talk to them.
To be a massive sort of capitalist party pooper, how's this funded?
Yeah, I mean, we're an educational nonprofit. The funding comes from grants. It comes from TED as a whole.
Yeah.
And from we've done some partnerships, but it's all, you know, we're very committed to keeping the content free forever.
Yeah.
So we just seek out funding and make it work.
Make it work. And so is the idea then that all of those assets are shareable, so people can go back and use them in the classroom, or, you know, as you would lend a book to a student, you can lend them the video, or, you know, send them the link to the video? And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we publish everything on YouTube, and it can be embedded anywhere. I mean, I guess it's a little more difficult for classrooms that block YouTube.
Yeah.
But we're trying to get content up on TED.com as well, and that will hopefully be a way to work around that.
And how long has it been going for? Because obviously TED now is like a massive bastion.
Yeah.
TED Ed,
I think, started in 2012. At least that's when the content first started being developed.
Okay.
And that was before I was there. And so I guess 5 years out, we have about 800 original animations, and then a number of other pieces as well that we've published. So we have a pretty rigorous rate of publishing.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny, I was having a conversation with a startup yesterday, and he was having a bit of a sob story with me about how he thought that it was unfair that Khan Academy was free and it was distorting the market, and wouldn't it be better if we had to pay for it, which made me laugh a little bit. But what's your thoughts on that?
On, as it pertains to us, or as...
Well, yeah, because I guess it's a similar idea in the sense that, you know, it's amazing high quality content that's free.
For me, the promise of the internet is being able to give access to high quality educational materials and resources to people around the world for free. You know, to make it a for-profit and paywall driven enterprise is, I think, it's a little terrifying.
Yeah.
But I think it's anathema to what the internet stands for, or what it can be.
And with TED, obviously, you have you're well known for the live events. Mm-hmm. With TED Ed, I think you have events as well. Is that correct?
We do. So we have something called TED Ed Weekends now.
Okay.
And what it is it's basically a TED conference for youth by youth.
Yeah.
So we have programs called TED Ed Clubs, which are around the world, and it's a program by which that empowers students to develop their presentation literacy. So there's a curriculum that a teacher or a student can curate and help their classmates or their students develop original ideas and then deliver them in a talk, which they'll record. And then our team, they can put those online, and our team will find the best ones and bring them to our office, where we have a stage. And we have this event, TED Ed Weekend. I think the next one is coming up over the summer. And it'll be chosen from TED Ed Club speakers, mm-hmm. and the audience is TED Ed Clubs.
That's
and
really
so
cool.
it's the most amazing thing, because there's this unbridled enthusiasm and optimism. And like, I think it's my favorite TED event that I've ever gone to.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been to the Biggie then?
Yes.
And what was that like?
It's a trip.
Yeah,
I mean, it's...
Do you feel like a lot of pressure about... I mean, there must be some incredibly smart people in the room, and including yourself, but there must just be like, right, I've got to bring my A game in terms of conversation.
A little bit, but I have the advantage of, because of my job, I get to ask people a lot of questions and find out what they do and figure out if there's a story with what they're doing that we can work with. So I get to, the pressure's off me a little bit. I just have to, you know, listen and ask the right questions.
Yeah. So who is your favorite speaker at one of those events?
At TED at large? Mm. I really love Sarah Kay, who is a poet, a spoken word poet.
With the animations, do you have a favorite... couple of animations.
There's an animator that we work with a lot named Avi Ofer, who does really beautiful sort of, they're hand-drawn, and there's this great energy to them. He has a very distinct style, and everything he does I think is brilliant. And he's also brilliant animator, in that he's always layering ideas. That so the way we work, we develop a full script, and we don't specify the visuals. So I used to work in documentary production.
I was going
to
ask,
make a two-column script where you're saying the narration is this in this section and the visual is this.
Right.
We do this differently, partially because a lot of the way we work is with animators, we give them the creative lead over the visual style of the piece. So, and not just that, but they're determining what each shot is. And that's part of the reason that they want to work with us is because we give them this freedom. And so we just give them a script and they come up with a visual approach. And now we're very deliberate in figuring out the right animator for the right project. But a lot of that visual creativity comes from them. And so sometimes the animation will very literally depict what's on screen, and sometimes you get someone who is, you know, it has a familiarity with a subject, or will research it, or is just like has a worldliness that they can bring a lot more information out through the visuals. So Avi is one of those. We also have an in-house animator named Jeremiah. We have four in-house animators who do brilliant work. Jeremiah he takes on pieces like what is Orwellian and what do Kafkaesque mean, and sort of how do you recognize a dystopia, and creates this whole world around them.
He must be in demand at the moment.
Yes, you can say that.
Yeah. Interesting. And what was your own education like? So I always ask people who come on the podcast.
Sure.
Yeah.
I studied math and playwriting, and sort of everything I've done has been at the intersection of those things of communication and, you know, hard science or math. So I started out working in theater, doing dramaturgy. From there, I went into documentary film production, and from there into creating online games for Nova. And now, and along the way, while I was making documentaries, I got really interested in exactly what I was talking about before with the internet and the promise of, you know, access to great materials. And that was sort of in the height of the MOOC era.
Right.
And not a lot of people were doing much with narrative. Mm-hmm. And so my feeling was, this is a perfect medium for telling stories and gripping people through stories. And that's sort of when I started looking at the education landscape and ended up here.
Have you heard of FutureLearn?
No.
So FutureLearn is like a UK-based, the CEO is here, I interviewed him yesterday. I think they have about 5 million users, and they aggregate lots of MOOC content, so from lots of different universities and so on. But the guy that runs it used to work at the BBC. He launched the iPlayer. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's like their digital offering. And then worked with the Open University, and the Open University actually like launched FutureLearn. But yeah, I guess that they're here, and also some others. I just wondered, you know, that would be quite... Because I actually asked him, are you thinking of doing sort of more diversified content after just sort of the university courses? So yeah, maybe you could plug into what they're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I got to seek them out.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any books, resources, or people that have sort of shaped how you approach the world?
I came to this late, but Douglas Hofstetter's Go to Lescherbach. It's a book about a very obscure but important mathematical theorem that basically says that there is a limit to mathematical logic, because you can develop a statement that is self-contradictory through math, similar to if I said this statement is false, that's a paradox in itself. It can't both be true and be false. You can do a similar thing with mathematics. So he wrote this 600-page book that is about that, but he along the way connects it to genetics and AI, and this was like 30 years ago, I think. I think it was during the 80s. It may have been earlier, but he intersperses that with these little dialogues. They're almost like little Platonic dialogues, and it's between characters like Achilles and a tortoise, and each of the dialogues is almost a little play in of itself that illustrates the idea that he then deconstructs and really picks apart and talks about mathematically. So he did this brilliant blending of narrative and imaginative narrative with fact, and you know the most logical, straightforward fact of mathematics. And I wish I could say like that launched my thinking along those lines. It's more that I came to it down the line and it sort of crystallized for me what you can do, and how you can blend approaches.
Which is increasingly important, I think, that, you know, science and arts aren't siloed. And I think people are becoming a bit more savvy to that now as well. Yeah, final question, I suppose, is really to understand. So from your point of view, what's the mission of TED Ed this year? So if people are listening in that are involved, that are either working in schools or higher education or on the industry side, what would your message to them be?
So I mean, our goal is always about sparking and celebrating the ideas of students and teachers. We so far have developed a lot that is teachers speaking to students. We are thinking pretty seriously about developing content that is teachers speaking to teachers. This may be a little ways down the line, but it's something that we're thinking about pretty seriously and want to figure out the best way to figure out how to do that.
So helping with professional development and
Kind
of support network. That's very interesting. And what about if people want to contact you or want to find out more? Are you on Twitter?
I'm not actually on Twitter. I'm not very good with social media, but the best way is to get in touch through the TED-Ed website
And
through the contact form there.
Yeah.
And you're welcome to pitch ideas. I love pitches. There's just a form that you can fill out for that.
Yeah.
And then you can also reach out to me through that website.
That's so cool. Well, thank you very much, Alex.
My pleasure. Thanks, Sophie.
Hello, my name is Michael Cohen. I'm the tech rabbi on social media. And I was, up until a few months ago, a director of education technology for a K-8 school in Los Angeles. I'm an Apple Distinguished Educator, and what I'm really trying to do now that I've left my school site is to work with schools trying to really concretize and set up a realistic aim of true innovation and not just the buzzword kind of exciting innovation by taking a look at how collaboration, creativity, and technology can really redefine the process of learning in schools.
And in your school in Los Angeles, where you were previously, what were the kind of works or some of the projects or initiatives that you did that helped elevate you, I suppose, to this point of influence with others in the sector?
So a big piece of what we did as we began to launch our one-to-one iPad program was to focus really not on the device, but on what is possible with it. And so allowing students to have a certain degree of freedom to then realize that they needed more freedom. And when I say freedom, I mean that the learning isn't scripted. And so even though there might be a theme and there might be goals that we set for our students, the vehicle of technology allowed our students to really discover their own way of being accountable for the information that they needed to learn. Another area that was pretty amazing was how we would take, I think, trending types of technology and integrate them into learning in a way that I would consider very meaningful. So to take augmented reality or virtual reality or computer programming, coding, whatever these really, you know, hip and hyped up processes are, how can we really integrate them in and not just make them an external process or an external after school experience? So to take a writer's workshop in first and second grade and integrate coding in to that so that students could really visualize and almost mechanically develop with sequence and syntax and order the process of writing and really visualizing it. That program we actually presented at MIT's Scratch conference on. And so it's authentic things like that that I think we can take the technology of the time, the processes of the time, and make them a vehicle for meaningful learning that will make it worth it even when that type of technology becomes outdated and moves on.
Because you can't not engage with technology because it's very much a part of life, but it's also very much a part of technology that it will become outdated. And, you know, when we look back at some of the things we're talking about now, we think, wow, wasn't that clunky? But that's just part of the process of it, I suppose. So who's your favorite designer?
That is...
That's a toughie.
That is a toughie. You know, when I look at design, it's difficult to pinpoint a favorite. I'm also horrible with names. So in my head, I have like six, but they're all...
Also, you know, if it's a product or service or where you think, yeah, that's really exceptional.
Yeah, I mean, I think simplicity is amazing. So I think right now I did a little Periscope a few weeks ago, and I focused on a book called Presentation Zen, and it's by an author. His name is Gar Reynolds. I believe he's located in Japan, and he is unbelievable in how he focuses on simplicity and shape and color and the power of the look of a letter to convey a message. And I think he's significantly influenced the work that I do. I think that would be someone right now that I think would be very relevant for many, instead of just, you know, sharing a good designer, so to speak.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, there's websites, you know, that have that kind of, you know, that kind of
work. I saw
a
story recently where I think they even showed that the different typography that was used meant that people believed the content of the text to a greater or lesser so degree. So they were still saying, you know, for government documents, for example, that might be quite useful. But that was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I'm a nerd with typography.
Yeah.
It's something that I am always engaged in. And it's very true. You know, I always think about, you know, if a stop sign was in Times New Roman, it wouldn't really be taken as seriously, I think. And there's actually, I had a friend tell me a story, because the government actually, at least in the United States, they have a set font. And I remember hearing a story about a document that was, I think, about 2,000 pages that was done in the wrong font, and they literally ditched the printed product.
Copies.
Right in the trash, no good, back to the drawing board. So there is a sensitivity to fonts carry a certain persona, and that's something that in with the students that I always tried to focus on. I had one students create the most amazing project focusing on one of the events of the Revolutionary War, which I always wonder what they call, or do they even talk about in the United Kingdom?
Maybe not.
Right. So, but why I mention this is because it was a case in point example of how being thoughtless about font and color can really make a project that could be amazing in its content be really worthless. So what happened was, it was the greatest project ever that I'd ever seen from these students. It was a multi-touch book with animation and with first-person writing and with plays that they acted out. But they chose Laker colors, purple background with the yellow font, you know, the sports team. And
it's,
I was like, it's a great color. They said to me, and I said, but it's not appropriate, and now it loses its significance and its impact. That was part of a much longer story as I developed this with students.
There's an amazing book on penguin and typography. So when they started doing all of their kind of cheaper paperbacks, so I'll have to dig out the link for that and send it to you as well. But so I'm here visiting South by Southwest EDU. It's my first time to come to this event, and I guess I'm very much coming as someone with a limited knowledge of American education, should I say, as in I don't have first-hand experience of that. And so these conversations are really important. So what I wondered was, you know, from your point of view, what do you think are the real driving issues for people here? So say, you know, some of the top priorities for educators and the limitations and challenges that they're facing as well.
So this is a very volatile time.
Yeah.
There's been a major government turnover. The leadership is controversial, I think, whichever way you look at, whatever side of the political spectrum you're on. But I'm trying to take, I think, a different approach. I think that there is cause for concern, and we shouldn't ignore or not take seriously who right now is in the leadership of American education as a, you know, Secretary of Education. But on the same, you know, with that said, I've looked at some educators that inspire me that are looking at it as a constructive conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what's going to happen over the next year, 2, 3, 4 years is that education is going to change drastically. And I think that the pressure and the whatever people feel is a hit against public education is going to make public education, the quality of it, increase dramatically. And I think that the standardized process, these you know, Common Core standards and the testing standards that are really the core of education in the public you know, education community, I think are going to change. And I think it's going to allow a lot of what I talk about with creativity and collaboration and technology really transform to something that's focused on why the types of learning that happen in our educational experiences should be a a springboard for our passions and our talents, and really to focus on that and less about skills and information for their own sake, but how do those drive forth something amazing that make
And so you feel like the change, although it has its own pressures, sort of that process of change allows sort of new avenues to be explored as well?
I hope so. I mean, I would not want the other side of the coin where, you know, education is destroyed and it becomes corporate and privatized and goes in a negative direction. Mm-hmm. I don't want to think like that, and I can't ignore that those realities exist. I mean, look, I'm in private education. I'm a product of public school. I have very negative feelings of my experience in public education, mm-hmm. and that's not to say if I had a private education it would have been any better. Yep. But I never felt that my passions were appreciated and my creativity was appreciated, and I never felt that the learning was relevant, and it was because it wasn't marketed and packaged in the right way. So I think something is going to change, and I hope it's for the positive, and I hope that the larger American education community can really band together,
yeah,
and say that it's about the children and not about our feelings or our wants and desires, but about them being successful.
And when we spoke about your influences on the design side of things, how about anyone else in terms of one person or books or people that you follow perhaps on Twitter, and it doesn't have to be in education, that have helped shape your philosophy on life? So not just necessarily on education, but that have been formative, because we like to share the kind of books that people have read and have had an impact on them as well.
Yeah.
You're bringing a list up. That's very good.
Bring a list
That's so
up,
organized. I love it.
I'm so bad with names of everything.
Yeah.
But I can remember faces 20 years later. Right?
Yeah.
So that's
the
thing. So one book that I'm only through the first chapter, and I even made a slide in last night just to share this unbelievable thing. So the book is What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20. Dr. Tina Selig at the engineer school at Stanford. So I'd seen her TED talk before, but I never read her book.
Yeah.
And that book I highly recommend. If the rest of the book is anything like the first chapter of just totally out of the box creative thinking that has little to do with talent and more about just thinking out of the box, and really she doesn't say it explicitly, at least this early in the book, but focusing on empathy, mm-hmm. and really connecting with people and valuing people for their uniqueness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think because I'm a Orthodox Jewish rabbi who mm-hmm. is very much in a public environment where my culture is different, my certain lifestyle components are very different. So
yeah.
I would want that respect and care and value looked at for me. So it goes without question that I should have that same, you know, same look and view of the people that I engage with, you know, in the greater world, which is sort of like a side point. So there's also, you know, there's as far as like things that are not in education specifically. So there's a book that I just bought, Austin Kleon's Steal Like an Artist, which is definitely going to be, I think, a major influence for why I'm writing a book on creativity. Because I'm reading his book and I'm realizing that I wrote 40 pages of a book. I sent it to a publisher, and the publisher basically said, this is a textbook, this is an expertise book, and it lacks your soul. It lacks your personality, and it doesn't tell your story. So we don't publish textbooks, we publish stories, we publish people. And so he said, you know, what about all this creativity that you do, your art and your design and your visual communication? So I started to write the book about that, and I felt a little stuck, like, how am I going to do it? So that book was unbelievable.
So you're an artist as well?
Yeah,
I'm
an artist. My undergrad was in printmaking.
Oh.
And so wood carving and metal etching and lithography, screen printing, and that all comes into the influence of how I try to translate information and help others learn.
Yeah.
You know, I think those are the two.
I have a friend that's an artist. She does... Cyanotypes, is it? She's like a chemical and creates these amazing artworks. I have to share it. But she's, so where I live, it's meant to have the highest density of artists in Europe, but they're all kind of getting moved out as that gets turned into flats and so on. But so it's interesting. But I think there's like a printmakers around the corner.
Yeah.
But
I miss it. I haven't done it in a while.
Yeah.
But it's something that I...
It's the problem of life, isn't it? It's like, yeah, if you do that, then you can't do the next thing. You need to, yeah, write the book. Okay, brilliant. And then if people want to get in contact with you, either to connect with what you're doing now that you've kind of moved on, and so you're working as a consultant. Consultant is a horrible word, but a creative, should I say.
Yeah.
How can they get in contact with you as well?
So they can reach out to me via The Tech Rabbi on just about any social media stream, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, my website, Periscope.
Impossible not to.
Yeah, yeah. And okay. Fortunately, the Tech Rabbi wasn't taken, so I'm able to
That's
get.
Amazing. You know, yeah.
I got them all. You know, I got them all. So that, yeah. You know.
The same thing when I set this up. I think I woke up like 4 in the morning, went downstairs at my in-laws, and then just, you know, decided, and then, you know, set them all up before someone else did.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Well, thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you support the mission of the EdTech podcast, don't forget to spread the word, join us at London EdTech Week, or sign up to our Patreon campaign. Next week, we're back with South by Southwest EDU special with a Norwegian chatbot in higher education. See you then.